We begin with a major ruling just handed down from a Leon County judge. The judge has struck down a map of the state's congressional districts that was drawn a few years ago by the Republican-dominated state legislature. This has thrown the state's political future into turmoil. Now, in particular, Circuit Judge Terry Lewis cited local Congresswoman Corrine Brown's district as symptomatic of the problem. Her district is notorious as one of the most gerrymandered in the nation. Speaking to our news partner last night, News for Jax, Congresswoman Brown expressed outrage about the decision.
The legislature had hearings all over the state of Florida, over 26 public hearings. They voted, the House and the Senate voted on the maps, and they voted for the maps for the House and the Senate. And in 1 week, one judge, one activist judge, going to throw it out? Unacceptable.
That's Congresswoman Corrine Brown speaking to News for Jax last night. Now, the ruling is virtually certain to be appealed before the state Supreme Court. However, this year's elections will proceed normally. It's what's happening down the road that will certainly make things interesting. Our question to callers right now, what's your reaction to the new ruling from a judge throwing out the state's congressional district lines? The redistricting fight is back on. Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. A.G. Gankarski, a lawyer for voting rights groups that had challenged the map, says it's satisfying to see this opinion.
Yeah, and you know, it's kind of interesting because Corrine refers to Terry Lewis as being an activist judge. Terry Lewis is a Lawton Childs appointee. Terry Lewis actually upset the birthers a few years ago when he ruled that Obama was a citizen. So if Terry Lewis is an activist for anybody, it's for the Democratic Party. And what this illustrates is the alliance between Democrats like Corrine Brown in the state Republican Party. And that's exactly what Terry Lewis's ruling addresses.
Now, Fred Matthews, the state's congressional map is being declared illegal and constitutional. This after the voters overwhelmingly approved that fair district constitutional amendment in 2010. The state's voters for some years have said they want the district, the lines redrawn. The political food fight has been going on ever since, and it's not over yet.
It's certainly not over. I mean, it's a good logical argument to say that we want districts that are compact and make sense and all that. But the realism of that is that before this, when it was done this way, minorities were not elected to national office. Bottom line, because there weren't enough. They're required to be roughly about 500,000 people in a congressional district. There simply is not enough in the districts where African Americans live, where Latinos were living at the time in South Florida, to get congressmen into Washington. Now, if what the group is saying holds weight, and everybody agrees to it, what you're going to end up with is fewer African Americans from Florida, and possibly fewer, not that many now from South Florida, that are going to be going to Congress in the next decade, not this decade, because this ruling won't affect anything for the coming election.
The number to join the show, 549-2937. John Byrd, Dan Scanlon, what about the argument from the state's League of Women Voters? They've said that these gerrymandered districts, while appearing to give a special preference to, say, a congresswoman like Corrine Brown, that what it's really about is to preserve Republican power around the state.
Well, you know, anybody who looks at some of these districts and says they're not gerrymandered is, you know, I mean, come on. Is this really a surprise to us? I mean, these districts are set up for a political purpose, and it's, you look at a map and, you know, if you want to do a Rorschach test and tell me what Corrine Brown's district looks like, the word, it looks like gerrymandering to me. Fred's right, you know, that's why they were drawn, but there's another purpose why they're drawn. It also helps the Republican Party to get a district where lots of the African American voters are concentrated. That keeps those African American voters out of districts that Republicans run in.
And the name for it is packing and bleaching, packing African American and Latino voters into one district, making all the surrounding districts primarily white and Republican leaning.
Yes. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword. And obviously the judge has looked at it pretty thoroughly and feels that it just doesn't meet the mandate.
We'll go to your calls in just a moment. But meanwhile, Dan Scanlon, a listener named Shauna, tweets the show, why are the state's politicians even allowed to determine the districting? Why can't an impartial body do it?
Well, don't forget, redistricting is done like every 10 years. There's supposed to be numerous public hearings. There's supposed to be lots of public input. So supposedly the public is involved in this. And if we have to redistrict, change these districts, it's not going to be a short term. It's going to be a long-term public hearing. They have to do due process. And if anyone makes a mistake, then there's potential for another lawsuit coming through because, hey, you really messed it up this time. But I agree with John. For 20 years, we've been looking at this district meandering around, knowing that it was built specifically to do a certain job. But don't forget also, we are in the 21st century. Population density, population makeup has and will change. Any redistricting is years old by the time it finally gets into place. Populations have moved. So who knows how effective that gerrymandering may have been.
The number to join us, 549-2937. What are your thoughts about the new ruling from a Leon County judge essentially striking down a map of the state's congressional districts? Give us a call, 549-2937. Let's go to Ed in Orange Park. Hey, Ed, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yes, I agree with one of your members of your panel who says this is going to mean a loss of power for the minority community. In particular, I think of the African-American community. If you're going to have more of these districts at play, that would mean that they would change from one party to the next party, more likely to occur, which means the new person who wins will start all over on the bottom of the totem pole when it comes to seniority. And Corrine Brown's an example, have achieved enormous power, and you can see throughout the congressional side of the aisle with the African-American members who's been there a long, long time, which basically means they tend to be chairmen of the many committees and gives them enormous power. So I think that would be one of the factors that would be occurring if we start moving this district to make it more fluid.
Thanks for the call. And of course, over her years in Congress, Corrine Brown has amassed quite a bit of power. And her campaign slogan, Corrine Brown Delivers, she has borne that out time and again, bringing home projects and favors, let's say, to this congressional district.
Yeah, but at what cost, really? I mean, the thing about Corrine Brown's races for Congress over the years, she's never been seriously challenged. Her opponents always have one issue or another that preclude them having a real challenge, real debate. And Corrine Brown, whenever she's actually questioned on an issue, we've heard it on the show, we've heard it from other people, she shuts down discussion. And, you know, ultimately that points again to the idea of the districts as they're currently configured being ultimately undemocratic.
549-2937. Let's go to Scott in Mayport. Hey, Scott, good morning. Go ahead.
Morning. Good morning. You know, when I first started listening to the show, I didn't really have an opinion. And listening to Fred's explanation of why there is gerrymandering, I thought was interesting because it seems designed, like by his own admission, we've designed a program to elect people of a certain color rather than elect people on their ideas. And so we've already demonstrated we have a black president, we have black mayors, governors, you know, we're electing black. So it seems like we'd be better off electing people on their ideas, just electing people of a certain color. And I was wondering what Fred would think if I chose my doctor, lawyer, you know, based on the fact that their color. If I needed to know the color of that person of some professional service, would that be right?
That's Scott in Mayport. Thanks for the call.
You know, it would be nice if everything fit into a box, and when you saw a poodle, you liked a poodle. But you may not like a poodle. You may like a German Shepherd. I don't like cats. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have cat night at the ballpark, because everybody has them. The issue is that it is a question of representation of what you like and the persons that you like and that you feel comfortable with that speak the same language that you speak. If you use the model of South Florida right now, the Ballart family, who all were elected during the same time that Corrine Brown was elected to office, would not have probably gotten elected had not this gerrymandering process took place there. what it has done, it has uplifted the community there. Now you have a wellspring of candidates that are coming behind the Balart family, serving in Congress. I'm talking about Diaz-Balart family, that have come behind them serving in office now, who've done quite well and are in the same kind of power position that Corrine Brown is up here. It's just that we know Corrine Brown, we don't know what's going on down there. And there's the same kind of animus behind them in many cases because they've been in power for so long. So it's not a question of whether or not the process can be fair. It's a question of representation of your community. And there is going to be one congressional district in this part of the state that's possibly could elect an African-American, and that's why this was drawn, because there are not enough in a compact district to elect an African-American would have an opportunity to be elected. That's why they did this gerrymandering business. I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying that. But that's why it was done. To give the African-American a chance to run. Remember, Alvin Brown was one of those who challenged Corrine Brown many years ago when he first came to town.
What about, though, let me ask all of you, the state NAACP has come out basically opposing Diaz-Balart and Corrine Brown on this issue, saying that they support the Fair Districts Amendment and that they think it's time to redraw the districts, too.
Well, as much as we're talking about politics here, the judge isn't interested in politics. The judge is interested in the legal, arguments. And, we can all sit here as reasonable people and say, and look at these, handful of districts we're talking about and say, come on, really? And I think that's what the NAACP is looking at, too. They're probably just looking at it from a legal point of view more than a political point of view.
Dan.
Well, traditionally for decades in the South, it's been very difficult to get the African-American population out to vote. But there's been so many efforts to bring.
And of course, for many decades, they weren't allowed to vote.
But there has been success in getting everyone out to vote. There are buses. Political parties are running buses and getting people from senior centers to get out and vote. So I can understand the logic of NAACP saying that we are not in favor of this because we are getting the vote out. We are getting people out.
Therefore. Yeah, let's go to Steve in San Jose. Hey, Steve, thanks for your call this morning. Go ahead.
Yes. Hey, your guest was stating that if the gerrymandering wasn't there, that we would possibly not have African Americans and Latinos elected to office. But when these were done, we also didn't have a black president. But now we have a black president. So do we really think that racism still exists to where the white voter is not going to vote for a black,
but that was
Mayor Alvin Brown, for instance?
But that was an issue having to do with on the national level, just like if you did an at-large level. We have at-large African-Americans represented. Kim Daniels, I think, serves as an at-large councilman. The demographics play into a citywide vote just as it played into the nationwide vote, because California and other places who have the votes and the electoral votes on the presidential level play a bigger hand in that than if it was simply the way it was just 10 years ago. So it's a different set of demographics. But when we're talking about congressional districts that have a numerical requirement for size, that becomes different, and you're not going to, and if you take Jacksonville, if you confine the borders of District 5 to Jacksonville or Gainesville, you're simply not going to have enough. You may not have enough. They haven't had enough of it at this point to get enough of a majority of African-Americans, let's say, in that district to elect a African-American to office. Not saying it couldn't happen. But you may not have enough. We simply don't. If you just take a look at the population of Duval County, you just don't have enough. We're looking at 35% African-Americans totally in the county. Then when you divide that up among all of the places where African-Americans live, you come down to zip codes 7, 8, 9, and 10, you don't come up with very much more than maybe about, 85,000 people.
Let's go to Richard on the north side. Hey, Richard, thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to just, there was a call, and I think the last couple of callers kind of mentioned you have a black president, so there's no more racism, or, the gerrymandering is to put black people in office. It's called the House of Representatives, not the House of Black People in Congress. The reason for the gerrymandering is to make certain that there's a representative speaking on the behalf of the voice of the people. There were times that the greatest gains African-Americans made was right after slavery during Reconstruction. And with the assassination of Lincoln, all of that was shut down for and 100 years of Jim Crow followed. We're right now on the path following that exact same chart of removing all the gains that were made when we could elect a black president. I guarantee you, after Obama is out of office, we won't see a black president for another 1,000 years, and all the gains are going to be removed, and it won't be long before we will have no representation. So we got to figure out a way. Yeah, maybe the Corrine Brown's district needs to be changed, but we still need to understand that it's about sending representatives, that my voice is going to be heard, and I'm not going to be pushed out with gentrification and all the other things that are going to make blacks insignificant in the grand scheme of things, because we will never be the majority. But we've got a long way to go. So I would like to make certain that the conversation is about representation and not about the color of a person's skin.
Thanks for the call. Lots of calls on this, but we do need to move on and discuss the other biggest stories of the week. That was certainly a big story, but also making headlines this week. Lenny Curry, the former head of the state GOP, challenging Mayor Alvin Brown for re-election, announced a hefty fundraising total, raising more than $560,000, his campaign war chest, of course, getting backing from everyone from former Florida Governor Jeb Bush to local Republican kingmaker Peter Rummel. Let us know your thoughts about the mayor's race, 549-2937. A.G. Gankarski, the Curry people, I think, are hoping to post such impressive numbers that everyone else just bows out of the race, in particular City Councilman Bill Bishop, who's also running.
Yeah, and I don't see how anybody really matches this. There's not a lot of air in the room. I mean, Brown's got his support, and, you know, Curry's taking all the money from the other side, and you can pretty much see a scenario where, you know, in the primary election, both these guys come up with like 35-40% each. I don't see a lot of competition here. It's kind of what I expected when Curry launched and when Rummel pointed to his support before even Curry actually applied to be a candidate.
So over $500,000, John. Curry, the best funded Republican in the race, but Mayor Alvin Brown has posted some hefty numbers as well.
He has. He's got Shad Khan and he's got Robert Clements of Everbank. So he has his own collection of heavy hitters. And he has taken a dip in the polls, but is still a pretty popular mayor. And I still think if Mayor Brown can get a couple of wins under his belt, if he can get some sort of resolution to pension problem, and if he can figure out something that he can say that he did to help downtown, he's going to be a very formidable candidate.
And give us your calls about the mayor's race. We'll go to your calls in just a moment at 549-2937. And Dan Scanlon, former city council president Bill Gulliford, is still considering getting into the race, too.
I just can't see how, when there would be two city council members going up against a mayor and a former party chairman, the former party chairman and the mayor can both tap into national bases for their funding.
Right.
They haven't gone to their heavy hitters yet. And, of course, the mayor keeps on saying every time you ask, it's too early to talk about, re-election. But I'm sure he's working those people saying, I'm going to need your help. I'm going to need the large groups to give money. And he's not that far behind, really, when you look at the numbers. $500,000 versus $330,000. All Mayor Brown's got to do is tap one friend somewhere and start getting some lobbying going, and the money race is on.
Fred, later in the hour, we'll speak with the CEO of the Clinton Health Initiative. They're in town this week talking about our area's health. You can guarantee former President Clinton's going to make a stop for Alvin Brown, maybe some other big-name Democrats, and they'll be writing big checks.
This is a big deal. It's a big deal statewide. The Democrats only have about three races that they're really going to concentrate on, and one of them is going to be the mayor of Jacksonville. And it's going to be a big deal nationwide about what happens in Jacksonville in this race. The tail of the tape will begin when the commercials start, I guess just after the November election is done. That's when we're going to see how the polls begin to change and how the jockeying is going to come. I think it's too early for us to really be serious about what they're doing. I mean, Lenny Curry is going to raise a lot of money. He's raised half of what the mayor, in 27 days, he's raised half of what the mayor's taken a year to raise. But those commercials, when they hit, and the impression that we all get from them, what impression? Because it doesn't really make any difference how many wins the mayor gets. Right. He's going to get hammered on being late on the pension form. He's going to be hammered for the taxis. He's going to get hammered.
The water taxis.
The water taxis. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's going to get hammered all the way around. So what impression is the electorate going to have? Are they going to, are they going to deem him to be incompetent or what?
Well, that's certainly the narrative local GOP operatives and candidates are trying to drive. But John Burr, is the general public going to buy that? Alvin Brown still has healthy approval numbers, mm-hmm. high name recognition.
Mm-hmm. I disagree a little bit, I guess, with Fred here. I do think that the mayor could use a win or two. He doesn't really have much to show for his 4 years in office, right as we speak today. And as far as the other candidates go, you know, Bill Gulliver would have made a very interesting candidate, but that decision should have been made 6-9 months ago. The train's left the station. I think AG's right. The oxygen is getting sucked out of the room, and in politics, money is oxygen. We've got our two candidates right now.
Lenny Curry and Alvin Brown. And you mentioned the water taxis, Fred. They're still trying to get those back up and running. Meanwhile, bike sharing is taking off in big cities around the country, and the JTA in Jacksonville thinks we could get the same thing here. Brad Thoburn, the JTA Vice President of Long Range Planning and System Development, says the Transit Authority is applying for a federal grant that would help fund bike sharing around town. Dan Scanlon, you think this will take off?
Well, you know, I just came back from a vacation to San Francisco. I've been to D.C. in the past year, and the bike sharing programs are rabid, rampant, and active as all get out, no matter where you are. People are grabbing those bikes, going out, parking them again, and they're everywhere. New York City has had some financial difficulties with their bike sharing program. The question is, Jacksonville right now, is it enough of a bicycling city versus the cities I've mentioned that a bike sharing program is going to be viable?
Let's ask our callers. Let us know right now if you want a bike sharing program for Jacksonville, and if you'd use it, give us a call, 549-2937. The new Unity Plaza AG would apparently be one of the places where you could rent a bike and tool around town.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just like with most of our mass transit initiatives, the urban core would really benefit from bike sharing. I don't know about Bay Meadows, Bartram Park, you know, places like that. But, you know, I could see bike sharing really working well with the young people in Riverside, Avondale, Springfield, all of that. They've been clamoring for things like this. And if this actually goes through, it'll be a slam dunk.
Right. That's where it would primarily be focused. John Burr.
And out at the beach, I think.
And out at the beach.
I would think. And maybe for the really adventurous, there would be some beach to downtown type of action going on there. The Wall Street Journal had a really interesting article actually yesterday on this very subject. There's something like 35 bike sharing programs now around the country. And besides outside of the really big cities, a lot of them are running into trouble financially.
Mm-hmm.
And also after the typical pattern is they start out great, everybody loves it, and then 9 months later it's like, bike?
So,
nah, I don't
so
think
do you
so.
Really just need huge urban density to sustain one?
I guess it helps. And also really bad car traffic helps because a bike can zip through that stuff and makes it very advantageous.
The other issue, too, is Jacksonville has long been said to be a bike-unfriendly area. There's certainly not a lot of areas that I want to bicycle in. Mandarin is one of them.
You can get clipped.
You can get clipped or hit by a truck mirror. So the question is, as has been stated, the downtown, the inner city would be perfect. And believe it or not, I see more bikes running around Riverside and downtown, mm-hmm. which have more traffic density than I do on a San Jose Boulevard, mm-hmm. where you are going to get clipped by a mirror.
We're getting lots of calls about the bike sharing idea. The JTA is trying to get a federal grant and start this bike sharing program in our city. Are you in favor? Would you use it? Call us up, 549-2937. Let's go to James on the north side. Hi, James. Good morning.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. Go ahead.
I got a question for you. Okay, I'm an avid bike rider. The bike sharing program, I mean, I think it's an awesome idea, but have we overcome the bike unfriendly city attitude did? Because I ride at the Florida Baldwin Trail, and that's the only place really where I'm at that I feel safe to ride. I mean, is this Is this issue going to be brought up before they start this bike sharing program?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, James, and one we were just discussing. That might be an impediment. The perception that it's not safe to ride your bike around town. We're not known as a bike-friendly city.
It's more than a perception. I've ridden my bike around town for about 25 years, and you know, there's certain guys in pickup trucks who yell things and throw things and swerve at the wrong time. And I don't know where they're coming from, but they're out there.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
They did that to you, Joan Burr? I'm going to have to go beat them up.
A striking figure on a bicycle.
Only in Florida.
Yeah, you can ask any motorcyclist how dangerous it is for them
on
a motorcycle.
Sure.
I mean, in spite of all the motorcycles that are now on the road, that is a big deal because people will clip you. They will cut you off. They will do that. So you have to have a trail for this. But even then, it's just going to be a narrow path on the side of all of this traffic. Did you see the full warrant today, this morning, with what was going on?
They're going to put a bike path on there, hopefully.
On there? I mean, it's going to be something else.
Let me bring this up. We walked the Golden Gate Bridge, and there are sidewalks on both sides. People walk the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, but half of that lane is set aside for bicyclists. I kept on waiting for a biker to come by and clip my wrist and break it because lane discipline is lousy. But they were thousands of people doing this in a very bike-friendly city, despite the fact that there's hills. So, flatland, it would be great. Yeah. I would even consider putting the backpack on and going.
Let's go to Mary in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Good morning. I think this is fabulous. Actually, I recently moved downtown to downtown Jacksonville, and I always think of the things that our city is missing that would really create a boisterous environment, you know, and just really get the people reconnected and united. So I know moving there and having two children, we recently moved downtown, that it would be nice if you could just go on the corner and find a little bike rental place and drive over Main Street, drive down to Riverside, go to the arts market on the weekend. It would be a really fabulous addition to downtown Jacksonville. So I'm in favor for it. I would utilize it.
Thank you so much. And that's Mary calling from downtown. Now, JTA is trying to get a federal Tiger grant that would help start the program. It would provide nearly $800,000 in federal funding. JTA would match that. And Brad Thoburn with the JTA says they'd try to set up a public-private partnership to deal with safety issues and logistics. Let's go to Patricia in Atlantic Beach. Hey, Patricia. Good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. I don't oppose the bike paths. However, I know we have the fourth worst reputation for being a bicycling city, but I think we have the worst bicyclists. And I travel everywhere. In Jacksonville, I live in Atlantic Beach. These bicyclists do not stop at the stop signs. They hog the road. At night, they ride their bikes up to the town center. They don't have lights. They get drunk. They wobble back. They don't even wear white clothes.
Was one of them, you know, like one of them? Was one of them John Burr? Maybe I don't know. I'm just kidding.
That sounds like the people who drive cars in Jacksonville.
No, I appreciate the call, Patricia. Yeah, so not everybody out there is being safe. You're saying
that's right. Especially running the stop signs. That's the worst thing. And then they give you a dirty look if you honk your horn at them. Well, I'm sorry, I have to stop at the stop sign. And one of the best things is you're stopped at the stop sign, the bicycles are behind you, and they zip by you on the right side going straight through the intersection. And I see it every day.
Wow.
And so I think we need some bicycling education, too.
All right.
That's my comment.
Thanks, Patricia, out at the beach. AG.
I think she's referring to the fixie culture there, basically, the sort of PBR hipster crowd. What this bike share program would do is actually make bicycling more mainstream so you don't have, like, rogue bartenders.
Fred and John are laughing because they remember when PBR was popular the first time.
Well, so do I. So do I. But, I mean, seriously, the bike sharing program will mainstream bicycling
and
all of those things, and it'll give people the opportunity to ride more safely, mitigating these issues.
So we're going to license bicyclers now. Is that what you get? We got to put a tag on the bicycle.
No, but
it's a revenue stream.
Course.
AG is correct. Any of us wearing our business clothes here would be more apt customers of these bicycles. We would just grab them instead of taking the car to that next business meeting that would be a mile away. We'd get on the bike, put the clip on our dress pants so we don't tie them up in the chains. sling the briefcase over the shoulder and go. I would be more apt to grab it. I understand that.
That's what I'm saying. In July, you're not doing that.
I would be more apt to do it, to run from downtown to Riverside on a bike or from my office to Riverside to do a story, and that way leave the car in the parking lot.
Sure.
So there is logic there, and it would bring a whole new crop, as AG says, of people who maybe don't do biking unless they go it on the weekend and put it on their truck and take it someplace.
Well, I don't go to the golf course after 11 o'clock because it's 100 degrees outside.
I understand.
I'm not going to ride to a business meeting. I'm sweating.
See, I would pay cash money to see you jump on one of these rental bikes. Both of you guys.
You should see the amount of bikers on the mall in Washington, D.C. on these rental bikes.
Oh, yeah, it's huge.
They are up and down the mall in D.C.
Absolutely.
They're tourists, they're business people, they are doing it. And you know, the exercise that you would get isn't too bad either.
And if they have them out at the beach, they'll be needed for exercise. Mm-hmm. Foodies are thrilled because Trader Joe's is set to open October 3rd in Jacksonville Beach. The grocer is a cult favorite. The opening day for a location in Tampa recently caused such a stir that police had to come in and control the crowds and direct traffic.
Woo-woo.
Are we really this bored? But I guess we are. There's much excitement over Trader Joe's coming to town.
This would happen if they build an IKEA here, too. My question about Trader Joe's expanding nationally is their distribution chain. You know, where's the distribution center at this point? It works in California, but as far as Tampa and Jacksonville, you know, these national grocery chains, you know, they raise questions. I mean, for me, I'll just keep going to grassroots.
Hmm. Well, they were going to build one. They were actually in Jacksonville at one point, and then they were looking at Southeast Georgia. But I don't think they've settled on a point for a distribution center. But they've got Tampa, they got Orlando or Winter Park, and now they're going to have Jacksonville Beach. So, you know, a distribution center does start to make sense.
Sure.